The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to More Than a Muse. I'm Stani.
I'm Sadie, and we are almost at Halloween. Halloween
yes.
is this next Tuesday. And so in the spirit of the holiday, we are continuing with our More Than a Muse Murder Mystery Month. And this is going to be a little bit of a shorter episode because it's kind of like a bonus content episode that we're doing alongside a book that we read this month.
Yes.
Do you want to introduce the book, Stani?
Yes. First off, if any of you are new here, we have like a new platform. We used to try and read a book every month. That's kind of impossible because both Sadie and I work full time, as well as have other side things we're working on, as well as this.
Yes.
We don't know how to stop working.
Correct.
So now we just read books during our two favorite months, which is Women's History Month in March and then October, because it's fun. And so this one, of course, had to be on theme. And we found this book. It's called Savage Appetites for True Stories of Women, Crime, and Obsession. Mm-hmm. And it's by Rachel Monroe. It came out in 2019. And it's really interesting.
It was so interesting.
Yeah, she kind of talks about like these archetypes of people that get invested in true crime. Mm-hmm. And they are the detective, the victim, the defender, and the killer. And kind of how different people attach themselves to that and how that might explain like true crime obsession. Mm-hmm. And then she tells the stories of four women who kind of fit within these narratives. And I'm really glad she talked about the first one because I thought about her at the beginning of this month and I was like, oh, that would have been a good person to cover because she like, I'm not even explaining who she is. She's known as the mother of forensic science because she made the little nutshell dollhouses that help people understand crime scenes and like recreated them. And I think it's like such a cross between like true crime and art in such a weird, like macabre way.
Yeah, truly.
So yeah, we'll probably cover again in the future for sure. And then we also, it also talks about a woman who moved into the Sharon Tate guest house where the Manson family murders took place. Or one of the Manson family murders took place.
Yeah.
And kind of how she becomes very intertwined with the family.
Yeah, it was interesting.
That one was strange. Mm-hmm. And then the other two are about a landscape architect in Brooklyn who fell in love with a convicted murderer on death row, who was the supposed ringleader of the West Memphis Three. And then, like, they got married, and then she devoted her whole life to getting him free. That one was really interesting.
That one was crazy. Yeah. And, I mean, spoiler alert if you read the book, but, like, they did get free.
Yeah, so he was completely innocent.
He was completely innocent.
It was a part of the Satanic Panic, which I've read up on before. Have you?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was kind of crazy to see that overlap. And then the last one is actually about a teenager who was involved in this like online fandom for the Columbine killers and then like planned this whole mass shooting of her own. So, yeah.
Crazy. Yeah.
Just very, very crazy stories that have to do with like women and true crime.
I really love the stories that she chose to tell. I feel like the reason why is because I mean, there were things that I was like vaguely familiar with, but it was able to like bring a whole new perspective in on it by singling in yes. on those very specific instances. You know what I mean?
And I
thought it was so interesting.
I agree. And I feel like it covered such unique points in true crime history. Like, okay, were you ever like a true crime buff? Like, are you still?
I don't really consume any true crime content anymore. Like growing up, I would watch like Dateline with my mom. I had like a phase of listening to true crime podcasts, but I don't really consume the content anymore. I started getting like a little bit too scared of functioning in the world.
Yeah.
because of
it. I relate.
And for my own mental health, I stepped aside. And then now I think more recently people have started being a little bit more critical of the true crime world mm-hmm. and like how it, you know, I don't want to, what's the word? Like
it got
profits on victims. Yeah. And mm-hmm. I see that perspective and agree with it, I think. So
I agree.
I don't really I don't really indulge in the content anymore.
Yeah. I was really into it for quite a while. And then, yeah, kind of got burnt out on it, as well as like I want to make sure that if I am consuming content like that, that it's done ethically.
Yeah.
Like you mentioned, like that's a major concern. Because one of my things is like I used to love Criminal Minds and it got really dark, so I had to stop watching it. But I loved how they mentioned there was this quote that they said once. I actually used it for like a school project, that Ted Bundy video I did. But he talks about how like by giving the murderer like a name, you know, like mm-hmm. the Golden State Killer or whatever, you're glamorizing them and you're removing the names from the victims. Yeah. And then he mentions that like everyone can name Ted Bundy. Everyone can mm-hmm. name like all of these horrible people, but like hardly anyone knows the names of their victims.
Yeah, you should talk about the project that you did.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in my like Motion 1 class in design school, we had to create like a project and it could really be anything. And at the time, the Ted Bundy movie was coming out at Sundance, which is in Utah. Yes. Mm-hmm. The one with Zac Efron. And there was a bunch of buzz about it and like controversy because like they were like, well, Zac Efron's hot and Ted Bundy is a serial killer. Mm-hmm. And then people were like, well, Ted Bundy was hot. And it was this whole conversation. And I kept thinking about that quote and just the fact that like we were sitting here and we were talking about Ted Bundy, and something that comes up a lot and I think is notable is that Ted Bundy lived in Utah for a time period. So like yep. everyone in Utah has like Ted Bundy stories.
Ted Bundy story. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so it's just kind of one of those like phenomenons that's linked to our state. But I couldn't name a single person that he murdered, even the ones from like our home state. And everyone I talked to couldn't, and it wasn't being mentioned in a single article. And the movie wasn't about any of his victims. It was about the relationship he had with his girlfriend. And so the project was to, like, put names and faces to these people that, like, he killed so many women. I think it was, like, 40 that I did in the project that were, like, the named ones that were confirmed. And then also mentioned the fact that it's believed he killed upwards of 100 people. Yeah. And we just don't know all of them because he didn't confess.
Yeah.
Even right before he died. And Sadie actually wrote a custom mm-hmm. song for it and put that to the Motion. And it was really powerful. I have to post it.
Yeah, you should. Because didn't it get removed from YouTube?
Yeah, I had to delete the account that it was associated with. Mm-hmm. And so it did remove itself from YouTube. But
I posted it to the More Than Amuse YouTube account. Honestly.
Yeah, I really should. Because it was like our little collaboration mm-hmm. that we did together. And I still believe in it so much. I didn't show his face for like more than a second. And his name was nowhere in the project. And it was mm-hmm. like really important to me. And it took freaking forever.
Yeah.
And the hardest part, I think that's actually when I got burnt out on true crime, was that project. Because I had to read into like every single person's story to find out where they were from and their birthday and things about them and find photos of them that I could. Then I had to write up like how they were killed and where mm-hmm. they were found and how he found out. And I listened to the Ted Bundy tapes on Netflix, which is actually incredibly done. Mm-hmm. It's way better and more ethical than the Sundance Film Festival movie. So if you want to learn about that, then I would mm-hmm. recommend those. But after that, like I was having nightmares about becoming a Ted Bundy murder victim.
Yeah,
and I had to take a break for a really long time. I still dabble in it like every once in a while, but like I live alone. So, I mean, I try to be smart about consumption.
I feel like I got to a point where I was like living in a very, very safe town in Utah. And I was freaking out walking from my driveway into my home. And I was like, you know, this isn't a healthy way of being. Like, it's good to be on alert. And that's actually something that the book talks about. I'm holding the book, by the way. This is what it looks like. Don't mind my dollar bill bookmark. Anyways, but like the book talks about the fact, like, because of almost like the way that people consume true crime content, they're like more aware of it. And so they're like, it basically how it's skewing the perspective of actually how much violent crime is happening in the world.
Yeah.
Because statistically, it's actually violent crime has gone down mm-hmm. since, I don't know exactly, maybe the 90s or the 2000s.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's because people know they can't really get away with it as much, or I don't know the reasons.
Every decade, I'm sure it goes down because like our technology is also getting better. Like if they're solving crimes they didn't have before with DNA, like you can't get away with it anymore. Like the myth of that idea is gone. I also think that like people are just, they have other ways to like expedite their rage if they have
that's
it. Like
honestly fair.
Yeah. So hopefully like we're getting to a point where it's less of an impulse to kill someone.
Yeah, I guess. Something that I thought was an interesting point that she makes at the beginning of the book when she's like setting it all up is, I don't know if this is like the full thesis of it, but I thought it was just an interesting point where she is bringing up the fact of like why people will say that they like crime. Like she goes to like Crime Con. Is that what it was called?
Or like can I read the conference quote?
Yes, please do.
Okay, I have the quote here. She, it was at Crime Con. And so she says, sometimes women's attraction to true crime is dismissed as trashy and voyeuristic because women are vapid. Sometimes it is unquestioningly celebrated as feminist because if women like something, then it must be feminist. Which, no, but... And some argue that women read about serial killers to avoid becoming victims. This is the most flattering theory, and also, it seemed to me, the most incomplete. By presuming that women's dark thoughts were merely pragmatic, those thoughts are drained of their menace. True crime wasn't something we women at Crime Con were consuming begrudgingly for our own good. We found pleasure in these bleak accounts of kidnapping and assaults in torture chambers, and you could tell by how often we fall back on the language of appetite, of binging, of obsession. A different, more alarming hypothesis was the one I tended to prefer. Perhaps we liked creepy stories because something creepy was in us.
Yes, I loved that one because, I just feel like that's like everyone who has a true crime phrase, and myself included, it was like, oh, no, I just do this so like I feel prepared. Like we make so many excuses, but it's like, no. It is an excuse, you know, like at the very end of the day, it's because you like it.
Yeah.
And maybe it's okay. In some ways, maybe it's okay that you like it. In other ways, you know, maybe figure out what's coming. It's okay to like creepy things, but like, you know what I mean? I loved how frank she was in that quote.
Yes.
I loved it.
I agree. Because I've been one of those people that's been like, oh, it's just to prepare myself. And then it's like, she's right. I'm not listening to it like taking a vitamin every morning. it has nothing to do with that. I think like part of it is just fascinating, right? Like,
it's
humanity finds it fascinating.
Exactly. It's like a human response to like almost like the forbidden things, or not even forbidden, but just like the things that we just can't understand.
Yes. Because it's like most people, I would say, I would hope, the majority of people could never imagine ever getting to the point in your life where you would take another person's life like willingly, like, you know, like that would just never, like self-defense is a whole other thing, but like like serial killers, they make no sense, and it shouldn't, like it's a damaged brain. And so I think there's like a weird fascination with that, and I think that's a thing that's been around forever. I think that's why detective stories, like we've talked about this month, are so popular. Like solving the crime. One thing I really liked that she brought up is that true crime shows and true crime stories where there's like a solution, it's comforting to people that like the craziest situation,
they're like the worst, most insane evils in the world,
stuff can all just be tied up so nicely, so nice and neat with like a little bow to be like, ta-da, here's the person, they'll go to jail forever and everyone's safe again.
Yeah.
Like it's like a fairy tale for adults.
Totally. Yeah. And I think it almost, like I said, it's like a comfort against the evil in the world, because the older you get, I think the more you learn about the potential evil that's in the world. And so, it's like nice to like watch a TV show where the heroine faces that and then solves it every single time and like never gets it wrong. You know,
it is satisfying. I completely agree. And like where all the clues come together and the solution all clicks and everything makes sense again and all is right in the world. Like, it's not crazy that people are drawn to that. I don't think that that's a weird thing.
It doesn't make you a weirdo or a bad person. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, totally obviously not. The true crime industry is huge. They are the top podcasts in the history section on Spotify, which why until true crime dies down, we will probably never reach the top of the charts.
That's okay. We'll find our way to the top.
There you go. Here's our one episode in the true crime sector.
Watch this be our most downloaded episode ever. It's fine. Another thing that I really loved about the book that I think provided really necessary context was the way she talked about how the justice system was affected by, like, in the victim section specifically, where she talks about Sharon Tate, which I thought the way she talked about it and the different perspectives she gave with, like, the woman who moved into the home and then became very interwoven into this whole narrative, but, like, how she was able to talk about the way that Sharon Tate's mom advocated for victims. And while, like, on the surface, of course, you see, like, oh, advocating for victims, like, of course, that's like a thing that you would just immediately have would be good. And it is good. But then she was also able to point out the ways that, like, it ended up having different implications that they weren't necessarily ready for, you know, where it's like suddenly there was this, like, huge war on crime, which, like, of course, like, if someone says, I'm going to fight crime, of course, you're going to agree with that. But then that led to people being punished in maybe more severe ways than their actual sentencing should require. Or I don't know, just like, it was interesting to, like, read about the differences and how that changed over time, especially with starting in the first chapter, where we basically read about how a woman was the person who laid the foreground for crime scene investigation and how it's done today. Like, I think that the way she wove that narrative connecting the stories was really, really interesting. And I learned a lot from it. Like, it really made me think about the different perspectives and, I don't know, the pros and cons of everything that she was discussing. I think she was able to handle those, like, delicate issues, like, very thoroughly, if that makes sense.
I agree completely. I loved the first section, like,
me too,
so much. It was just, she had this one quote that I was trying to find that I can't remember exactly, and I listened to it on an audiobook, so I don't have the paper. But she said something about how, like, women's obsession with miniatures is because they had, like, their own little home and world where they could control everything and no one else got a say. And I was like, oh my gosh, that makes so much sense. And it even makes sense with, like, dollhouses and stuff. Like, that could be a large part of, like, why women are kind of obsessed, because it's like their own little world that they get to control. That one just really blew me away.
I fully agree. I never even really heard of that either, too. So, like, after I went and looked up the little nutshells on just, like, on Google, and they're pretty gruesome and very like, thorough and accurate. Like, they're oddly beautiful. I mean,
they are.
They're beautifully gruesome, but it was really, yeah, it was
really think cool. They're so fascinating. And the fact that, like, some of the dollhouse solutions are, like, locked away in a safe and they're not publicly known.
I know.
Yeah. And then she talked about how she deliberately made one where the crime scene was tampered with by the cops that came to visit so that the crime can never be solved. And I was like, oh, that is so poetic and eerie. The fact that she was like, look what happens when you mess up. There's no solution.
You're never able to solve it.
Yeah.
I forgot about that one.
I think it's so fascinating. I remember, like, learning about these at some point. It had to have been, like, high school. I heard about someone made dollhouses of murder scenes, and I was like, that is so odd. But I think it's such a fascinating thing, and the fact that they've, like, survived all this time and, like, are still used as a part of training of, like, how to look at a crime scene and deduce what happened. It's just really cool that she was such a huge part of that.
Yeah, no, I agree. And, like, with the money that she was able to, like, give to Harvard to start their own crime scene investigation, I thought that was really interesting. I know that the department that she started doesn't necessarily exist now, but but still, it was just, like, it was a lot of stories of what one person can do, you know, for the good and the bad, potentially, you know, with
definitely
the story of what she did with the nutshells. What was her name? Frances Glessner Lee.
Yeah, I was like, Frances Lee, I think.
But yes, Frances Lee. And then also what Sharon Tate's mom was able to do as far as advocacy for victims. And then with the Memphis Three, what was her name? Lori? What she was able to do, or what she was able to be a part of to help them become free. That chapter was like, I felt my heart rate going up as they would be like, oh, and then we'd appeal, and then it would go nowhere. Or when they talked about the fact that they were able to prove through DNA that the three that were convicted, that was nowhere on the bodies, and even still, and then they presented it to a judge and he still was like, ugh, that's not enough evidence to, like, open another trial.
It was like, it wouldn't have been enough evidence to convict them. It just, that one drove me nuts.
Mind-boggling.
Because, like, the Satanic Panic was such a huge, crazy thing. I remember, like, I think I listened to, like, a whole thing about it. It had to have been, like, last year or something. And I was explaining how, like, the Satanic Panic never happened. So it wasn't necessarily, like, true crime. It was, like, debunking. It was a podcast.
Like, all the people claiming that they escaped groups that were sacrificing babies.
Yes. And like, they were talking about the fact that, like, in the 1980s, people kind of just went crazy and started claiming that they had been a part of a satanic cult and had gotten free. And it usually came out after a long time of, like, therapy from something else, which is exactly what happened in this, too. And there were these people who, like, there was these two nursery or daycare employees who got sent to jail for all of the children that they nannied, saying that they were being locked in cages and beat up and fed humans and stuff when they were at daycare. And obviously, that isn't what was happening. It also talked about how, like, police interrogations can, like, lead to wrongful confessions.
And that's what happened with the Memphis Three.
Yes, because people are put under immense pressure and then their body goes into fight or flight, and the need to get out of the situation where they feel threatened changes their brain, and so they, like, make stuff up. And they found that kids are, like, most guilty of that, and that's exactly what happened with the Memphis Three, is that they put another kid in confession and they, like, sat in there and grilled him until the point that he broke and was like, yeah, they did it, especially because the cop had it out from the beginning.
Like, when he publicly, when they asked him, like, oh, how confident are you that he did it? And he said 11 out of 10. Like, just.
Yeah.
Those. Because
he wore black nail polish. And
yeah.
He was, like, more goth. And so they're like, well, he obviously. Because what? Where was it? Kentucky?
I think Arkansas.
Yeah.
Somewhere they were there. They were in jail in Little Rock, Arkansas.
Yes, that's right. Mm-hmm. So it's just, like, small southern town, and they were so convinced about the anti-Christian satanic panic movement, especially because policemen were having, like, seminars about it and talking about how they needed to watch out for Satanism. And it was such an issue, and it's so crazy to look back on now and be like, there weren't millions of Satan worshipers in every neighborhood. Like, that is such a weird thing to think about.
I know.
But to the point that, like, it even made it to, like, Riverdale. In the past this season, they had, like, a huge satanic panic there, too. So it's just absolutely crazy that that led to so many wrongful convictions. And, I mean, the Memphis Three were just part of that. Like, there was so many more.
I know. And, like, thank goodness that at least they were able to get out. But then at the same time, like, the deal that they were able to strike was that of, oh, like, you can get out, but you can't seek restitution from the state, and you technically have to plead guilty. So it's just, like, these weird horrible stipulations, and it was just because the state didn't want the magnifying glass on them of, like, well, what did you do wrong? Because then it would put up all those past convictions into questions, and then that's just, like, opening a can of worms. But for me, it's like, so you're okay with all these people being wrongfully put in prison? It's just, oh,
I was like,
it's so horrible.
One should ever be okay with someone being wrongfully convicted and put on death row.
Yeah, that's scary.
For literally decades. Like, that is insane, over complete lies and a recounted confession. Barely any evidence. They said he had an alibi that was pretty solid. So it's just like, that's not okay. And
yeah,
that's
their
where,
evidence
yeah.
was, like you said, that he had, that he wore black nail polish. And he was, like, goth and liked magic.
Yep.
That was it.
That was it. He just didn't fit in. So it's just such a problem. But yeah, I think, like, that touches on another part of, one thing that I wasn't expecting with this is her kind of poking holes in, like, our justice system, which I obviously knew had problems. But, like, I didn't think by talking about women and true crime and obsession that that was going to come up so much. And it came up in every single story.
Yeah. I thought that was really interesting. I really loved that, too, because I think it made me, I don't know, not that I'm, like, fighting, like, one way or the other in the sense of, I don't think about criminal justice a lot. But it was just, like, a good reminder of, like, oh, that's something I need to be mindful of with who I'm, like, voting in. You know what I mean? Like, there's a responsibility to, like, be aware of it, and enough that you would be like, this is what I think needs to change to make it better for people.
I agree. I wish I could remember the names of all these things. I did listen to another podcast that talked about them, like, coming up with the racial profiling system. which didn't actually immediately intend to be that. And this kind of reminded me a lot of that too, how like people have good intentions, they come in with good ideas and they intend to like make positive changes. Mm-hmm. But then because it relied on like probability and stuff, it ended up becoming like a, well, these people are more likely to commit crimes in this area. So if you see any of them, you just stop them. They're most likely committing a crime. And it's like, no, yeah. That's not how it works.
Yeah, that leads to very problematic things. Yeah.
Yeah, but I thought about that, especially with like the nutshells and how they talked about how forensic science kind of got away from everyone for a little bit. And it was like people were relying on stuff a little bit too much. You know, like it's just crazy how quickly things can go wrong.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a very important thing with like when you're convicting people of crimes and like changing their lives and throwing them in prison. Yeah. Like, they should be taking every effort possible to make sure that like things aren't going wrong.
Yeah. And another thing that she talked about in the section about victims is that it's so easy to like only look at people who are perfect victims. And she brought up a tragedy from her hometown where a girl went missing that like was a lot like her, you know, like she identified in her, but then later found out that there was another person that went missing at the same time. And just the difference in media. But then also there was one specific moment where it was like a detective on the case, someone that was interviewing one. And then they were like that the detective like cried over the person that went missing that, you know, she also personally resonated with. And then someone asked him like, oh, well, did you cry for the other person? And he admitted that like, no, I actually didn't. And so it was just like this interesting thing to point out of it's like, do we only feel sympathy with the people that like look like us? And she even she equated it to a certain study that was done of like that the empathy that a person would have for even just like someone who shares their favorite sports team and like how quickly that changes like your empathy for that person if you find out that they're rooting for a team against you. The point of that is saying that like if there's even anything that makes you feel like an other from another person, it immediately affects the way that like you perceive them and stuff like that. And I thought that was such like a sad point, but like a really cool
point.
It blew
my mind, honestly. I was like, people wonder all the time, they talk about the Stanford prison experiment and all this stuff, and they're like, well, how can good people do horrible things? And it's like, if your empathy goes down by just putting someone in an opposing team's jersey, like, can you imagine when you're trained your entire life to treat them as less than?
Yeah.
Like, your empathy is probably so far gone that you can't even feel it for them at that point. And it's just like, that is such a dangerous thing.
Yeah.
Like, that is so crazy. Yeah. I think we also saw that with, like, Gabby Petito and kind of the craze with her. And obviously, that was such a horrible tragedy. But, like, so many people brought up that they're like, oh, you know, like a white blonde girl goes missing and the whole nation's like reading every line. And yet how many missing Indigenous women are there? Like more than we can ever even keep track of.
Yeah.
And it's just, yeah. So it definitely shows that like people kind of handpick the ones that get more attention than others.
Yeah, definitely. And there's definitely a trend in the ones that we do care about more than others.
Yeah.
They seem to, which, you know, like kind of fit the mold. So, yeah, I thought that so many points that she brought up, like commenting on the stories, I thought they were all very thoughtful and like, yeah, like really made me think about things and kind of examine the way I respond to crimes and victims, but also the perpetrators sometimes.
Yeah. Even.
So I thought that was really, I don't know, I really loved this book. I would definitely recommend it.
Yeah, I agree, especially if you're like really into true crime. I recommend reading it. I think it helps you reframe things a little bit better in your brain. And I think, yeah, become more ethical consumers, which at this time with like there's such an overconsumption of it that I think
you
it's
could
really
like
important.
Only consume true crime content and you'd have enough for the rest of your life.
Yeah. Seriously. So I think, yeah, it's an important thing to keep in mind. There's been like a lot of movies and other things that have been made without victim family approval. There's been stories that have been twisted, things that have been publicized that people don't appreciate. Like, it's just important to make sure that we're, of course, advocating for the people who lost their lives in such a senseless way. You know, like not taking advantage of the situation for personal
and like
gain.
The sensationalizing of it. I know with like the most recent Jeffrey Dahmer movie. That brought up a lot because it's like the victims don't want to watch a reenactment of the brutal way that their loved ones were murdered. Like,
yeah, that was
we don't need to see that. It's
yeah, definitely. I agree. I wanted to end with this like final quote. She talks about like throughout the whole book, it's this reoccurring idea that she's trying to figure out why women get so invested in true crime and why specifically women. And to be honest, I don't know if there's really an answer. Like, mm-hmm. I think people just have obsessions, and apparently it tends to be one of those things with women, just like men in football, you know? Yes. It's just like stereotypically more that fit.
Their interests. Yeah.
But one thing that she said is that like a lot of the times people assume that the reason why people become obsessed with stories of violence is because of like their own history of violence mm-hmm. or violation. And then she said, except that women in the survey clarified that they weren't just talking about harm that had been done to them personally, but societal trauma too. A lot of them mentioned 9/11. And then she had this beautiful quote, pain doesn't have to be personal to be a motivating force. And I loved that, like, because yeah. that was kind of my whole thing behind like the Ted Bundy project that we did for mm-hmm. school. And like, you know, I think that that's such an important thing to remember, that like pain is a motivating source, but it can be external too. It can be something that you just witness. Yeah. Like it can be the lady who saw the video about the Memphis Three and then decided to write letters to him and fell in love with him in the process. Yeah. Like it can be like Frances Lee, who noticed that there was discrepancies in forensic science and decided to make dollhouses of different crimes in order to help and like literally dedicate her life to it. Mm-hmm. It doesn't have to be inflicted upon you in order to like motivate you to yeah. change things.
Yeah, I agree. And I thought that it was a really cool thing that she like, yeah, she did point out the fact that it's like Frances, she didn't have a violent background at all. You know, it was just mm-mm. something she was interested in. And the same woman, yeah, who fell in love, like she didn't have a crazy weird backstory. She just was really drawn to the documentary and something compelled her to write to him, and that was enough.
Yeah. I often wonder sometimes too, this is just like my conjecture, if maybe people that have like easier upbringings are almost drawn to it in a way because they just can't imagine the injustice of living a life like that.
Yeah, honestly. Yeah. Because yeah.
if you've had a very like chill, normal chill. Life, yeah, then yeah. the idea of something like that almost feels just completely outlandish. Like you mm-hmm. can't even fathom a world where that would be possible.
That's true. Yeah. And it like maybe just increases the fascination and intrigue in a way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very, very interesting. Very highly recommend.
Yeah, absolutely. It's, you know, a good fit for this time of the year for sure.
Yeah. And it goes into true crime stories without like being creepy. Like she didn't mm-hmm. spend forever like dissecting the Manson murders or anything like that. No. Like, so I think it's a good one.
Totally. Well, we have one more episode coming out this month for More Than a Muse Murder Mystery Month. So be sure to check out our next episode coming out on Monday. And then we, of course, just have content every Monday moving forward. So leave us a rating, leave us a review. Come find us on Instagram at morethanamuse.podcast. Subscribe to us on YouTube. You can now watch our videos. Watch our podcast.
We would love to get 1,000 subscribers. That would be amazing.
That would be amazing. We're at 17 right now. So
yeah. So it's definitely like a thing. But like if you listen on a regular platform and you just have a YouTube account and you wouldn't mind like going and subscribing anyway, that'd be great.
Yeah. We'd very much reach more people on there.
Yeah.
Well, until Monday.
Until Monday. Bye.
Bye.
Everyone is talking about magnesium. It's all you hear about. But why? What do we know about magnesium? Well, magnesium is the number one mineral that 75% of Americans are deficient in. If you are a woman over 35, magnesium will help you rediscover balance, energy, and vitality. Magnesium supports more than 300 enzymatic reactions in your body, including those involved in hormonal balance. From functional medicine doctors to mental well-being and female hormone experts, we all know that magnesium is the one mineral to improve all aspects of well-being and health. But which one? Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, the trusted choice recommended by leading experts, with 7 best-absorbed forms of magnesium to ensure your body receives the support it needs for overall well-being. Go to bioptimizers.com/balance today and use code BALANCE10 for 10% off. Support your journey to wellness at bioptimizers.com/balance. Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers, your foundation to optimal health and vitality.
Okay, round 2. Name something that's not boring.
Laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.